Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast where Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts discuss international issues of the day. My name is Natasha Kassam and I direct the Institute's Public Opinion and Foreign Policy Program. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome two of Australia's leading journalists to the podcast. Michelle Graddon is one of Australia's most respected political journalists, who has been a member of the Canberra Parliamentary Press Gallery for more than four decades. She has worked at all the major Australian papers and was the editor of the Canberra Times. Michelle is currently chief political correspondent at The Conversation and has an academic appointment at the University of Canberra. Catherine Murphy has been Guardian Australia's political editor since 2016, working in Canberra's Parliamentary Press Gallery for 23 years. She's also a professor at the University of Canberra, from where she was awarded an honorary doctorate in October 2019. She's won a range of journalism awards, and her latest publication is her 2020 quarterly essay, The End of Certainty: Scott Morrison and Pandemic Politics. We are just so lucky to have these two press gallery veterans to talk to us through the view of the world from Canberra. The politics, the policies, and of course, my personal area of interest, how public opinion fits into all of this. So Michelle, I'm going to start with you. With all of your experience, can you just give us a sense of how you feel the landscape has changed over time? Is foreign policy playing a larger role in the public debate than in the past?
I think foreign policy and defence policy, for that matter as well, come and go as issues. It's not a constant front of mind issue with the public in Australia, but at times it is, of course, a quite big issue or set of issues. And we just have to remember back, for example, to the Vietnam period where people were very concerned with foreign policy, with our engagement in Vietnam. Many people had their sons and their brothers, their relatives there. We had conscription. It was a huge thing in the late 60s and very early 70s. Again, after the 2001 attacks in the United States, foreign policy, defence policy came to the fore and was a quite big issue. It had an effect in the 2001 election, helping John Howard. Currently, of course, it's not at that sort of high level, but the rise and the assertiveness and the aggressiveness of China has made it a considerable issue again, although at a second level.
Well, Catherine, when we think back to our federal election in 2019, barely a word was said about foreign policy and let alone about China. Heading into the next election, it's hard from my perspective to imagine that happening again. What's your view on how foreign policy is featuring in Australian public life compared to the past?
Yeah, well, I think Michelle's given a really excellent summary there as in terms of the waxing and waning of foreign and defence policy over time. It's certainly an issue now, and you can see the government setting up an election frame where security will be a significant, what would you call it, backdrop, drumbeat. It's hard to be exactly precise with the words, but you can see the government setting up an election which is being fought along themes of these are dangerous times. The pandemic has shown us that we're at a complex point in global history as well as domestically. And Michelle harkened back there a minute ago to John Howard and 2001 and the backdrop of geopolitical and security issues in that campaign. I suspect we'll see a similar campaign, whether it's the end of this year or next. Not that there's an active conflict in play in Afghanistan or the Middle East, but just with those themes, the rise of China presents great uncertainty in the world, great uncertainty in our region. I think if we put it in crude political terms, it's at times of great uncertainty, who do you want? You want the incumbents. So I think we can see that coming a mile off.
Well, speaking of the incumbents, Catherine, I mean, one of the things that was interesting when Prime Minister Morrison came into office is people like me talked about how he hadn't really been that interested in foreign policy previously. He now seems to be kind of enjoying going to the G7 and talking about these issues. What do you think about how kind of the man has changed in terms of that area of interest?
Well, if it wasn't terribly long ago that we were into negative globalism.
Yes. at the Lowy Lecture, in fact.
Indeed, at the Lowy Lecture. So not very long ago, we were into negative globalism. Now, there's been a whole sort of set of conversations and also a shift in events that's brought the Prime Minister back into multilateralism and the benefits of multilateralism. And now we see quite a different tone, I suppose, to how some of these foreign policy issues are discussed. I think the pandemic's been really helpful too. I know that's a very odd thing to say with Sydney in lockdown and Darwin in lockdown and Victoria in long spells of lockdown. And please don't think me without empathy in saying that the pandemic's been helpful. The pandemic has been helpful for nothing. But in terms of this, call it the education of Scott Morrison in terms of global affairs, I think what he's learned through the pandemic, through forging, through regular dialogue, even more regular dialogue than normal between leaders of countries, in small groups, in large groups, bilaterally, leaders of countries have all tried to learn from one another, have been in regular dialogue, want to understand what's worked in various jurisdictions. And perhaps that, in a strange way, has proven the benefits of multilateralism to Scott Morrison. And also, because of the particular geostrategic threat of China's rise, it's also very important and in Australia's interests that we continue to engage our allies in this region. We continue to engage the US. We continue to engage Britain and the Europeans. So I think Scott Morrison's a very flexible and adaptable character, so much so it can be very hard to get a fix on him. But I think what he does is learn and adapt, and sometimes in plain view. So in a very short period of time, we've gone from multilateralism being a bit dubious to multilateralism being great.
Well, another thing that has changed, some would argue, Michelle, is that our foreign policy has been hijacked by the national security hawks in Canberra. And people make this claim particularly about our policy towards China, but of course, more broadly as well. What do you think about that, Michelle? Is that something new, or is that, again, something that has come and gone over the history of Australian foreign policy?
I do think at the moment that the defence establishment and the national security establishment more widely is quite hawkish. A number of the personalities in it are hawkish. It's interesting that Paul Keating a couple of years ago pointed to this and suggested that they were sort of derailing sensible policy on China. You'd probably have to distinguish the Foreign Affairs Department from the wider intelligence and security establishment. I don't think Frances Adamson, for example, former ambassador to China, who's just left as head of the department, is particularly hawkish. We don't know who her successor will be. And the diplomats tend in general to be, as it were, more diplomatic. But we do have in the fairly recent, the appointed Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, obviously a hawk, and Andrew Hastie too, who's his junior minister, is as well. So that is right. And it's at a time when, of course, there is a lot of debate about where China is at precisely, more importantly, where it's going in the future. And that has enormous implications for us, the region, and indeed the world.
Well, what do you think about this, Catherine? I mean, the news cycle is so rammed these days, but one story that gets a daily run is about China. And the Lowy Institute poll and other polling shows that public opinion towards China has slid into such negative territory in recent years. Does this surprise you? And how much of this do you think is driving policy in Canberra, or is it the other way around?
That's a very interesting question, whether it's chickens or eggs. I think Though, no, look, the short answer is I wasn't surprised by the numbers in the latest Lowy poll, but there was an interesting nuance in your poll that I thought was quite noteworthy. People are in the community more concerned about China and are getting that sort of base level of anxiety is increasing. But I thought it was very interesting in your poll that voters too, though, are not entirely certain that the Morrison government is getting this relationship right. So you can have sort of two headspaces that exist simultaneously. You can be worried objectively about the rise of an autocratic power in our region and an autocratic power with a lot of... Well, we have very close connections with China because they are, of course, our most important economic relationship. So people can just look at the world, follow the news globally, follow the sort of drumbeat of political conversation locally, and come to their own views about whether or not they're anxious about China's sort of hegemonic ambition. But then they can also look at their own government and say, oh, hang on. Are you guys helping or are you making this worse in terms of how you're trying to frame this relationship in the public space? And I think, anyway, your results were particularly interesting because it showed the complexity of, human inquiry, that a number of seemingly contradictory thoughts can exist simultaneously, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. And it's one of the reasons I find, all polling and the ones that I work on particularly interesting, because I think so often people do have quite complex and curious views about these issues, even though there is perhaps sometimes an expectation in Canberra that the public don't care or aren't that engaged in these issues. So, Michelle, one of the things that I'm also really interested in looking at Canberra is that there seems to be very little dividing the opposition and the government on some of these matters of substance. There's been, some discussion and some commentary from Penny Wong and others about whether the government has been disciplined enough in their messaging, some pointed comments about the Wolverines, a particularly hawkish group of backbenchers and others. But what do you think? Do you think that there's a difference between the major parties on Australian foreign policy?
I think it's very much at the edges. It's over issues like foreign aid, for example. I think there is a reasonably sharp difference. But if we come back to the central issue and China in particular, I think that there's not a great deal of difference, mainly because the two major parties do have, or two major sides, do have common views basically on the issue of China and how we should be responding. But within that, there is an attempt by the opposition to say, well, the government hasn't exactly got the balance right, that it's not nuanced enough, that its language at times and some of its actions are too inflammatory or too forward-leaning. I think that the opposition would like to find some grounds of argument in this general area, but it is constrained by, as I say, the fact that in substance there's not a great gulf between them, but also it knows that public opinion is pretty anti-China at the moment, and that I think is another constraint on it moving into this area. And certainly I don't think it wants an election where defence and foreign policy issues are too much to the fore. It wants an election on grounds that it thinks will favour it more, the government's faults in the rollout at the moment, and also its own more traditional issues.
I think that's really interesting because that can go either way. And Catherine, I'm keen for your views on this, because of course, when we look at the Lowy poll and others, Australians think that COVID has been handled remarkably well compared to the rest of the world. But of course, now there are these issues in the rollout. I'm in Sydney in lockdown right now, as are several other capital cities in Australia. So how do you think the kind of question of COVID is playing out in this moment in Canberra? And do you think it's making Australia more insular and close to the world?
Yes, there's the question. I just want to say very quickly, just on the differences, if I can, between just on the question that Michelle gave a really excellent answer to. I just wanted to add one point. We did see Labor, a bit of adventurism from Labor during the Trump period. We did see Penny Wong, Labor's foreign affairs spokesperson, articulating very carefully and cautiously a case for whether or not America remained a reliable actor in the world, and what you do when the most significant global power of the 20th century is no longer reliable. So anyway, I just wanted to add that to the mix. In terms of COVID, well, COVID is, look, front and centre, I think, in the minds of most Australians. I think last year was largely a story of competence by their governments. Obviously, your perceptions on that might vary, depend on where you are in the country, and people refract these issues through their partisan leanings anyway. But I think, generally speaking, last year was a competence story. We saw trust return in institutions. We saw state governments who endured election cycles returned, often with positive swings towards them. So there was a sort of competence dividend in COVID last year. I think at the federal level, Scott Morrison's in quite a vulnerable position, because the story of this year predominantly has been one of not of incompetence in terms of the vaccination rollout. Now, obviously, there were elements of the vaccination rollout that went wrong that were outside the government's control. It's not as simple as, oh, they just stuffed everything up. That's not right. But it is true to say, demonstrable to say, that Australia was not aggressive enough at a time when other major economies were buying up vaccine supplies. And that's a supply problem that we are in the middle of right at the moment. And we know who is responsible for that. That is the federal government. And also, there just have been decisions relating to the vaccine rollout that weren't really optimal in terms of how to get vaccines to people. So I think Scott Morrison's had quite a tricky year on COVID this year. Whether or not, how forgiving people are, I guess we'll see when the next election rolls around. In terms of that point you made, though, about are we more isolationist? Well, look, closing borders has been dead popular, absolutely popular, both sort of going back to this sort of pre-federation internal border control stuff that we have not seen since Federation. And then we have the external border closure, which is, it's obviously, it's not accurate to say that this is absolutely 100% popular, because there's a bunch of Australians that have been stranded overseas throughout this pandemic who are beside themselves and just want to get home. So it's not universally popular. However, this idea of Fortress Australia, this idea that we can bring up the shutters against the rest of the world, against the pandemic, against others, is something that sort of, I think, exists very deeply in the Australian psyche. We live on an island at the bottom of the world. I think it is very much in the Australian psyche, that kind of backdrop of isolationism. And certainly the pandemic has supercharged it.
For me, it's really fascinating, because I've always kind of argued that Australians are globalists and outward facing, and even as publics in the UK and in the US have kind of turned towards populist leaders and turned insular, Australians have really remained pro-globalisation, pro-free trade. And so this moment of Fortress Australia is so interesting to me. What do you think, Michelle? Do you think that we're becoming more insular, or is this a kind of comfortable place as our island at the bottom of the world?
I think the whole question of safety has been very much to the forefront in Australia, and that's because we managed to contain the virus and to move towards an effective elimination strategy. Now, it's not, of course, a total elimination strategy because that's not possible. But you remember in the early days, there was a debate about living with the virus and a question of some people saying, and all through they've said, that we should accept a level of infection and have a more open economic situation. But as the debate went on and as the premiers in particular took a very hard line, or most of them, leaving aside the New South Wales premier, we have had this situation where we've gone after almost every case, as it were, or indeed every case. And so we've had lockdowns, even when there've only been three or four infections at a particular time. And this has sort of set the framework in which we've operated. I think we have become more generally protectionist in all sorts of ways in the last year and a half. But there's also pressure, I think, to open up, and particularly people saying, well, business, for example, saying we need more migrants, there are labour shortages. Catherine spoke about people wanting to get home, Australians, especially younger Australians, wanting to travel. So I do think that we are seeing now the debate widening out into how we go and conduct our lives into the future and when the liberalisation begins. And of course, the government's felt under this pressure, and we saw the plan, even though it's a pretty gossamer thin plan, announced the other day for a gradual reopening.
So, I mean, as you say, this has been kind of popular electorally, and I would argue that tough borders have always been good politics on some level in Australia. Catherine, we've seen some shifts recently in relation to the story of the young family from Biloela that have been seeking asylum in Australia. And we've seen a couple of LNP members come out and say that perhaps they should be resettled, in, you know, stark contrast to what the federal government's been saying for a number of years. Do you think that this points to any kind of longer term shifts in our immigration and asylum seeker policy from either side of politics, really?
I'd love to say yes, but I don't. I actually don't think. I don't think it does. I think it's sort of. It's often the thing with case studies like the Bilo family. It's sort of. It puts a face to an experience that is quite literally out of sight for most Australians for a period of time. People have been who arrive via in unauthorized maritime arrivals have been literally out of our sight. They've been at Christmas Island or Nauru or Manus, and the whole edifice of detention is very hard. It's not transparent. It's very hard to report on. So when the sort of deterrence, the harsh deterrence, which is Australia's policy, sometimes wears a human face, community attitudes do shift. And we've seen that with this recent example. But I think that we've sort of framed one of the election dynamics as being an election about security and safety. And you can sort of see during the times when Parliament sits, the government setting up Dorothy Dix questions on, not necessarily we stop the boats, but almost in that territory. So I don't think we're going to see a massive outbreak of humanity, sadly. Often, too, there's a gap between the messaging at the political level of deterrence and then what actually happens on the ground. Sometimes sort of more humanitarian outcomes can be pursued on the ground as long as the individuals don't gain a face that the whole country can recognise. I know that sounds insane, but it's sort of like there. It's kind of like a duopoly in the country of deterrence being the message. If you gain a human face like that family, then people become more empathetic, yet the government's room to manoeuvre shrinks. Yet if when humanitarian claims are pursued out of sight, sometimes humanitarian things happen. It's just we're not told about them.
Another space where the government's kind of room to move and community attitudes might stand in contrast is, of course, climate change. And Michelle, what do you think about the way in which this is playing out? We've seen the Australian public is more concerned about climate. They think the government's not doing enough in the majority. What explains Australia's approach to climate policy from your perspective?
This has obviously been a particularly vexed issue for a very long time. It's not really clear why Australia is behind so many other countries. The underlying forces, you would think, on at least one hand, that we have so much renewable energy and people are pretty enthusiastic about it, would take us to a progressive policy. On the other hand, of course, being big exporters of coal, there are a lot of vested interests on the other side of the debate. But nevertheless, it's now returned yet again to be a problem, a political problem on the conservative side of politics. We've seen Scott Morrison through recent months creeping towards an embrace of the 2050 net zero target. He knows that to have a credible policy for the Glasgow conference, he needs to get to that target. At the moment, he's saying preferably we reach that by 2050. And he did seem to be going along on a trajectory that would get him to that endorsement of the target in time. But then, of course, we had this absolute eruption in the Nationals, and a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of it was about concern on that target, that they might be pushed into accepting it, that the former leader, Michael McCormack, might have been just rolled over by the Prime Minister on it. And so the result of all that was Barnaby Joyce, who's been a constant critic of firming up that target, became Deputy Prime Minister. Now, I think that this is still a situation in flux. It may be that Barnaby Joyce would be persuaded if the price was right, as it were, if there was enough compensation for the farming sector to go along with the target. But there's no sign at the moment that that will happen. Everything apparently that he's saying privately since becoming leader is sticking to his old position of not endorsing the target or not supporting the government endorsing the target. So I think this is a very difficult situation for Scott Morrison and for the country.
Catherine, do you agree? Is it a difficult situation and no signs of shifting? And also I might ask you, you know, what about the international pressure here? Is the government concerned or worried about whether they need to do more ahead of the climate conference in Glasgow later this year?
Yeah, well, we see in this scenario Scott Morrison's caught between Boris Johnson and Joe Biden and the Nats at home, but it's sort of not quite that sort of clean. The dynamic that we're witnessing here is the coalition since Tony Abbott was defeated Malcolm Turnbull as Liberal leader way back when, has been that the coalition has sought to weaponise climate change during election cycles. There are parts of the country where the coalition has basically used inflaming sentiment about climate action to win seats. And that's in areas like central Queensland, some coastal seats in Queensland, and also seats in WA. Because elections in Australia are close. It's been a long time since we've seen a landslide election in Australia. Scott Morrison has followed a formula of trying to neutralise climate as an issue in the cities and weaponising it in the regions. So the difficulty has been for Morrison is that he's now caught between Joe Biden, who by all indications is not going to pat Australia on the head and say, thank you very much for doing nothing. We appreciate you doing nothing. Joe Biden has in fact been saying the opposite since taking office. Now, Johnson and the Europeans also want Australia to do more. And that means more than just saying as a bunch of motherhood, geez, it'd be nice if we preferably did something by mid-century. Two problems with that. One, all the main game in Glasgow is going to be around 2030, not 2050. And also this fudge, gee, I'd love to do something on by 2050, preferably maybe sort of no legislation, which is what Morrison needed in order to try and keep the Nationals on board. Well, that's not going to cut it internationally, and it's not cutting it with the Nats either. So it's quite difficult. But also, though, I think the reason we're here is because this strategy of weaponisation domestically has worked for the coalition. We see poll after poll where 70 to 80% of the country says, oh, yes, I want climate action. But at the end of the day, that's not how people vote. And that's the nexus that that we haven't sort of come to terms with in this country. That's why we haven't got climate action. That's why we've got rubbish policy, because of more than a decade of weaponising this issue on the coalition side. Now, I'd love to, you know, sort of say all sides and, gee, you know, aren't they all wicked on this? Well, they're not. I'm sorry. The coalition has an appalling, unconscionable record on climate action. And until they decide, as a couple of parties, the Liberal and the National parties, to act in the national interest and act according with principles that would make Australia a good global citizen, we will be back grinding our wheels on this debate over and over again. Sorry, I'd like to be more upbeat, but on this issue, I'm just basically narrating the evidence in front of us.
Perhaps a note of optimism from my side. I agree that, you know, climate action hasn't been an issue that people have voted on as a general rule, but, you know, the two decades we've been talking about the issue, I really do wonder if that's starting to change. And obviously, we'll kind of have to wait and see. But, you know, people are still saying that health and education are the most important things to them. I don't expect that to change. But climate is moving up that list in terms of the issues that people prioritise in Australia. So, you know, I am hopeful that perhaps that might start to change. Look, before we finish up, I had hoped to ask you both to briefly reflect on your own careers. You know, working in foreign policy in Australia, it's still very much a male-dominated field, and you're both such senior, successful women in journalism who started out at times when the field was so overwhelmingly male. So, Michelle, I might start with you and then go to Catherine. I wonder if you could both tell us how you feel about how the space has changed for women in journalism in Australia, and perhaps if you are optimistic on that for the future.
Well, I haven't, I must say, worked in foreign policy or had posts overseas, so my field has been very much domestic politics. Of course, sometimes that involves issues of foreign policy and defence policy and so on. On your question about record of women in journalism, I think that over the time I've been in journalism, it's obviously become easier for women to get through, and many more women have got through to the top levels. They haven't succeeded so well, however, at the executive level in news organisations. I think they're still relatively male dominated. In terms of foreign postings, I think that there have been many Australian women who've served in posts abroad, and some of those posts are incredibly difficult. I see from time to time, for example, the ABC's Anne Barker in Indonesia, and think how tough that must be to cover month in, month out through the various disasters that they've had. So I think that the landscape at the moment for women journalists is a pretty good one.
What do you think, Catherine?
Well, on this podcast with me is my most important journalistic mentor, Michelle Grattan. The reason I'm here is because she did so much to develop me as a journalist. We've worked together twice, once at the Financial Review and once at The Age. Michelle taught me everything that's important about journalism. And as a figure in the Parliamentary Press Gallery, we all owe her a massive debt of gratitude, because before Michelle had the jobs of running bureaus and political editors, if you looked, we have some historical photographs up and down our corridor here in Canberra, and if you look at them, there's a bunch of blokes in them. It was really women of Michelle's generation in the 70s and 80s that started to change that. And it was so much harder for them than it is for us now. And in all kinds of practical ways, Michelle had my back, teaching me how to be the journalist I now am, for better or worse. Sorry, Cobber. That is in very large part down to you. She also, when we worked together at The Age, I had quite young kids, and Michelle works Michelle's working hours are legendary, but she enabled me to continue to function at a relatively high level, to grow and to embark on opinion writing and other things while I had kids. And so I'm sorry to give this extended herogram to Cobber, but she would never give it to herself. And listeners of this podcast really need to understand how important a figure in Australian journalism Michelle Grattan is. So it's people like Michelle who've made life easy for me. At the moment, I work at Guardian Australia, which is a news organisation I'm very attached to, because along with Lenore Taylor, who's the editor-in-chief, we worked real hard to make The Guardian a thing in Australia. And I work for a female editor-in-chief, Lenore, and I am the Canberra Bureau Chief and Political Editor of The Guardian, also a woman. Doesn't mean clap hands, hooray, we've done it all. One of the most important story in Canberra, apart from COVID this year, has been the rolling horror show of Brittany Higgins and allegations of sexism and worse in the ecosystem that Michelle and I operate in, which is politics. So we got a long way to go, folks. We got an awful long way to go. But I tell you what, it's a lot easier for me than it was for Michelle. And the people I have around me in my team now, I develop as closely and as as well. I'm no Michelle Grattan, but I develop my team in similar spirit, and it will be easier for them than it was for me. And that's all we can ask for.
That seems like a very fitting tribute and a small point of optimism on which to end this conversation. I'm so grateful to both of you. We could have my own herogram today if we wanted, but Michelle, Catherine, thank you so much for your time today. You've been listening to Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute team, with production support from Josh Goding. We'll see you next time.